Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that, with an opening question. Who owns the Nile River? Is it Ethiopia or is it Egypt? A conflict is brewing in northeastern Africa over control of the waters of the Nile. Ethiopia has spent the past decade building the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam on the Blue Nile. That river starts in the Ethiopian highlands and meanders north to Sudan, where it joins up with the White Nile and then runs into Egypt. Ethiopia is supposed to begin filling the reservoir behind the hydroelectric dam, a colossal structure that stands some 500 feet high and is 5,800 feet wide, next month. But years of talks over how quickly the process should occur and how much water should keep flowing to Egypt broke down this summer. And now both countries are ratcheting up the rhetoric. Egypt is utterly dependent on the Nile. 90% of the desert nation's water comes from the river, and nearly all of its 100 million people live along its banks. But Ethiopia says it should be allowed to use those waters to generate electricity for the 56% of Ethiopians who currently go without it. If no agreement can be reached, Addis Ababa will proceed unilaterally and start to fill the reservoir. Cairo is putting in an enormous diplomatic effort to slow the filling, and some are calling for war. So here we have three different views of the situation, one from Egypt, and then from Ethiopia, and then one from Turkey. So in Egypt, Egyptians, according to a local publication, were fools for thinking Ethiopia wanted this dam for the noble goal of generating electricity. Now it's clear that Addis Ababa had an ambition to create a water bank to blackmail Egypt. Ethiopia wants to fill the dam's London-sized reservoir in only 6 years. And Egypt has asked for up to 25 years, which will radically slow the Blue Nile's flow and deprive Egypt of some 200,000 acres of farmland. When the process is complete, there's no guarantee that Ethiopia will let the waters gush freely again. Instead, Addis Ababa will expect Egypt to pay fealty to secure the country's lifeblood. But the Egyptian military is mighty. If our water rights are harmed, Ethiopia will suffer the consequences. Well, that is a view then from Egypt. Doesn't sound like they're negotiating in good faith, does it? Well, Ethiopia's view is this. Ethiopia has no wish to let Egypt go thirsty, but the dam is a matter of life and death for millions of Ethiopians living in abject poverty. Our poor citizens scrape their savings together to buy bonds to finance the $5 billion structure, making the dam a source of national pride. Egypt has long held a colonial attitude, and for decades was able to dictate how the Nile's waters are used. Ethiopia is willing to release plenty of water each year as it fills the dam. But Cairo must understand that the time of monopoly has come to an end in the Nile River Basin. Well, one from Egypt, one statement from Ethiopia, and now Turkey says this: a U.S. attempt to broker a deal has already failed. After Washington produced a document that was interpreted as heavily tilted in favor of Cairo. But there's still hope. If Egypt cools its language, and if Ethiopia offers to submit to African-led arbitration, they can prevent this escalation of tensions from ending in bloodshed. So it looks as though nationalism is rife in northeastern Africa at the moment. So stay tuned, and we'll see how this turns out. Suffering from coronavirus caution fatigue. In April, the COVID-19 pandemic felt like all anyone could talk about. It was the top story on the news every night. By and large, everybody who could was staying home. The pandemic felt urgent, immediate, and terrifying. These days, the streets of New York City, for example, the virus's stronghold in the U.S. for much of the spring, are filled with revelers drinking takeout cocktails. Las Vegas casinos are shoulder to shoulder with gamblers, and people in states across the country are again dining in restaurants, going to the gym, throwing parties, and generally acting as though the pandemic is a distant memory. It's tempting to think so. Between states pressing forward with reopening plans and summer weather coaxing us out of our homes. But the data show quite clearly that the virus is still here and it's still a threat. Yes? Daily diagnoses, hospitalizations, and deaths nationwide are now well below the pandemic's peak in April. But that says more about the pandemic's brutality at its peak than its impact now. Hard-hit areas like New York and New Jersey are seeing marked improvements, but case counts are rising in roughly half of U.S. states, according to a Time magazine data analysis. More than 12 have recorded their highest numbers of new cases in June. Over the 7 days ending June 20th, an average of about 26,000 Americans were still getting sick every day, and about 600 were dying. Those numbers still constitute a public health crisis. So why are we going back to normal life, even where the virus is still actively spreading? An associate professor of medicine at Northwestern University has coined a name for this phenomenon based on her 15 years of research into depression, anxiety, and decision-making. She calls it caution fatigue. She likens social distancing motivation to a battery. When lockdowns were first announced, many people were charged with energy and desire to flatten the curve. But now, months in, the prolonged mix of stress, anxiety, isolation, and disrupted routines has left many people feeling drained. As motivation dips and public officials give conflicting messages about what's safe, people are growing lax about social distancing guidelines and putting themselves and others in harm's way. So here are some suggestions for us to apply to our caution fatigue. I'll mention them first as a in a list, and then we'll talk about as many as possible. One is taking care of your health. Another is reconsidering your responsibilities. A third, switch your media diet. And a fourth is make altruism a habit. And number five, reframe risks and benefits. So let's go back to the first of these, taking care of our health. Get enough sleep. Follow a balanced diet. Exercise regularly. Don't drink too much. Stay safely socially connected. And find ways to relieve stress. Address the reasons for the caution fatigue. Think of it like quitting a bad habit. In reconsidering your responsibilities, try to think of precautions like wearing a mask or staying 6 feet from others as vehicles for doing the things that are important to you. When you think of wearing a mask and staying 6 feet apart as the things enabling you to safely join a demonstration, perhaps, or maybe take a walk with a best friend for the first time in months. Try to think of precautions like wearing a mask or staying 6 feet from others. These are vehicles for doing things that are important to you. So I've mentioned that twice because of its importance. And switching your media diet. This refers to just as we may learn to tune out the sounds outside our windows, we get desensitized to the warnings about coronavirus. Even something as simple as checking a credible news source you don't usually follow or catching up on headlines from another part of the country could help your brain to reset. It's important not to tune out, especially as life outside your window starts to look more and more normal. Making altruism a habit. Social distancing is really about the common good. In keeping yourself safe, you're also improving public health. You're ensuring that hospitals don't get overwhelmed. And quite possibly, you're saving lives. There's something powerful about hope, compassion, caring for others, altruism. Those values can help people battle caution fatigue. Just like anything, selfless behavior gets easier the more you do it. And lastly, reframing risks and benefits. People tend to overvalue what's already happened and assume if they haven't gotten sick yet, They won't in the future. But if your behavior changes and you have a gradual decline in your safety behaviors, then the risk may increase over time. Sometimes writing out the risks involved can be helpful for people to make sense of the right decision. Time magazine asks a group of historians to weigh in on what we can learn from low points of U.S. history. Here are some of the teachable moments that they selected. First of all, segregation wins in the Plessy versus Ferguson Supreme Court decision. Secondly, farm workers get left out of the New Deal, 1933 to 1938. The oil embargo begins October 20th, 1973. And in August 28, 1955, Emmett Till was murdered in Mississippi. I'd like to go back over those and give you a summary, beginning with the segregation wins in the Plessy versus Ferguson decision. In some ways, the Supreme Court's 1896 decision, which upheld Louisiana's statute mandating segregation in all public facilities, was the nail in the coffin. Since 1876, the courts and Congress had eroded the Reconstruction Amendments, the promises to African Americans for suffrage, equal protection of the law, and due process before the law. But the Plessy opinion and its embrace of separate but equal let African Americans know once and for all that despite those guarantees, their fundamental rights would not be protected. Plessy versus Ferguson, to remind you, was not overturned until 1954. And then, as American farm workers suffered a hunger, sickness, and dislocation during the Great Depression, President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal legislation did very little to improve their welfare. In fact, in many ways, it left them worse off than they had been before. At that time, Southern Democrats, with an interest in preserving Jim Crow, dominated Congress. Many farm workers were people of color, and consequently, unlike most urban industrial workers, farm workers were omitted from the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933. They were omitted from the Standards Act of 1938 and the Social Security Act in 1935. This exclusion condemned migrant farm workers to a life in America without a place to enact their rights. And then the oil embargo, which happened back in early 1970s. After the embargo, rather than rethinking our addiction list to oil, Americans expended more effort finding new sources of hydrocarbons and defending existing sources in the Persian Gulf. Unfortunately, we were too successful. We found enough oil and gas to wreck our climate and created a financial incentive not to limit consumption until it may be too late. And finally, we have the murder of Emmett Till in 1955. And this sent a message: by taking a black life, that was sadly common in Jim Crow America. But when Emmett's mother, Mamie Till Mobley, decided to display his lifeless body to be photographed in an open casket for the world to see, this was the catalyst that set the civil rights movement in action. Are children virus vectors? Well, a small new study from Chicago has found that children with COVID-19 carry just as much of the virus in their nose and throat as do adults, and that those under age 5 can host up to 100 times more. If confirmed, this finding could undermine a key assumption underpinning the reopening of schools around the world this fall: that children don't spread the virus as easily as their parents. The researchers examined levels of viral nuclei acid, genetic traces of the coronavirus, in 145 patients who had mild or moderate symptoms. And they found that viral loads in older children were similar to adults, but among those younger than 5, the levels were often much higher. Now, the study doesn't prove that children can spread the virus to others, but it does suggest that scientists have a lot more to learn about transmission in children. Research into the COVID-19 outbreak on board the Diamond Princess cruise ship has yielded some interesting clues. The new study found that 60% of infections on the Diamond Princess were caused by tiny aerosols. Good ventilation didn't prevent the virus spreading, which suggests that people should wear masks even in well-ventilated spaces. Many people have argued that airborne transmission is happening, but no one had numbers for it. In this paper, we provide the first real estimates. And then, as we end today's program, I have a couple of, I guess you'd call them, factoids. One is entitled Poll Watch. 55% of Americans aren't confident that the November election will be conducted fairly. Republicans expressed the most skepticism at 65%, while 46% of Democrats aren't confident. 86% of Democrats and 63% of independents and 23% of Republicans want to change election laws so that everyone can vote by mail. 55% of all voters said they are likely to cast ballots by mail in November. And a few quotations to end today's show. This one from the Montreal Gazette newspaper. A marriage is always made up of two people who are prepared to swear that only the other one snores. Also, romance is the glamour which turns the dust of everyday life into a golden haze. And one thing a person cannot do, no matter how rigorous his analysis or heroic his imagination, is to draw up a list of things that would never occur to him. And so that's about it for today. I'm going on the road again to find more items for our program. A little of this, a little of that. Please stay safe. Wear your mask. Social distance. And be kind to others. This is a very taxing time. We have to be patient. And by all means, think positively. We'll get through this. I'm sure. We got through World War II. We can get through this. So, for today, it's goodbye, and please come back.